Well, folks, we're back again, and this is another edition of Valley Edition. And here we have the full complement of panelists in the studio. Starting on my left, Zaz Hollander, independent journalist. And right there, smack dab in the middle, none other than Mark Kelsey, returned from a variety of places around the world. And on my right, Terry Snyder, blogger extraordinaire. And often referred to as the citizen lobbyist. Well, it's been quite a week this week, guys. Let's start off with the headline item, I think, of the week, and that involves the Matanuska Creamery and a recent indictment that's come this way. Who'd like to kick off with that?
Well, I'll kick it off since it came out of the Frontiersman. I'm pretty sure we broke the story, too, which is always good for us, but it's unfortunate for the Valley in general when news of this sort comes around, when there seems to be a constant struggle to improve our identity in the eyes of non-Valley people. I suspect somewhere in Anchorage, Andrew Halcrow is probably doing a jig. You know, he's been on this story since day one. And it turns out he was largely correct, unfortunately. Where we go from here remains to be seen, but it surely does not bode well for ag in the area.
Well, that's correct. And speaking of that, all the big players are involved. I appreciated the timeline that was provided by the Frontiersman. Starting back in 2007, how easy it is to forget. And we can throw out a whole bunch of names. There obviously are a couple of former directors of the Division of Agriculture, Rob Wells, and the present borough mayor, Larry DeVilbiss. This was something that happened also when Bill Allen was the USDA director. And there was a lady by the name of Sarah Palin during that time who was governor. And all of these players were very much involved in doing just, I think, what you've suggested, Mark, finding a way to keep that 71-year-old history of Matanuska Mat-Made Creamery going. What happened? Zaz, do you have any information?
Well, I can't say specifically what happened behind the scenes, but what happened as far as we've been able to see in public is that as the allegations go, Kyle Buse took at least $120,000, if not quite a bit more, and siphoned it into his own operations, who knows where, which is where the fraud case comes in. You know, I'd heard little dribs and drabs over the years of just, on a very basic level, the operation being really misoperated, not run very smart. Mechanics, you know, trucks not running right, just little things that when you've got someone really keeping an eye on a business may not be happening. I think this isn't good for the Valley. It's not good for accusations of sweetheart deals. You know, it does seem like that's what happened. A bunch of money went to a business that didn't deserve it.
And I think it's worth noting that, you know, I haven't heard anybody say there were bad intentions from the start. It surely appeared to be something that was born of good intention. You know, keep an iconic dairy, an iconic business going. You know, very well intended, and it's just another sad example of, you know, good intentions being abused and taken off the rails.
Okay. Terry, anything you'd like to observe about this?
Well, I don't think we've even probably heard the total, what's going to be the fallout from this. I think we know one person is under serious investigation, and there's probably much more to come out. I think it is totally sad. It's sad because we're at a time when we need to be deciding what to do with agricultural land and how we're going to preserve it. We only keep about 2% of our food here, and this probably doesn't bode well for keeping a lot of ag lands or cows or anything else. I think it also probably gives more voice to those that think government can't do anything right, and we'll probably be hearing from a lot of people, you know, how this, you know, could have been avoided, shoulda, woulda, coulda, will probably be pretty fluid. And it is interesting to know the FBI is busy still. They have sort of job security, it would seem, and we're not the only place in the state that's the case. So,
well, and that's true. I can remember myself throughout that period of time, the good feeling And I think it was captured in articles describing what happened. And a lot of people that I spoke to since that time, in fact today, have said, once again, everybody wanted to make it work. And maybe that was part of the problem. Yes.
Well, I just wanted to add that, you know, when I was at the Daily News, I wasn't reporting on this, but Stephanie Komornitsky was, and she spent a lot of time reporting on this issue, and, you know, she wasn't looking for positive or negative, but I remember stories about budgets in the red. I mean, this is not new. Financial problems that Matt made in its new incarnation are not new. And meanwhile, Karen Olson, one of the partners, is trying to keep the operation going, and there's the, you know, the current ag director, Francie Habemeister, is now obviously a player in that because her family is selling milk, and that apparently was part of the problems, at least as far as Karen is concerned, is a third of their milk supply went away when Habemeister started their milk supply. So it's a very convoluted story. But it wasn't, you know, from my memory of it and Stephanie's reporting on it, there was always a question as to whether this was ever going to be running in the black and running successfully.
Right. Okay. Well, yeah.
Yes, Mark. I would add a quick sidebar to Terry's comments. This surely will fuel the fire of those who think government has no business in private or what should be private business. It will be added to the list with Delta Barley and a couple of other projects, the fish plant. But you never hear about the successes, the FedEx terminal in Anchorage, the Skagway Ore Terminal, the Ketchikan Shipyard. These are huge, thriving projects that never would have happened without the support of the state. So there is good that the government can do.
Okay. Okay. Well, moving on then. Let's come closer to home. What we have going right now is the end of the year and the end of the process of budgeting for one of the entities centered in Palmer, and that is the city of Palmer. The other two bodies, the borough and the school district, are just beginning their process, and they'll be finishing up in July. But we did have the completion of a budget process for the city of Palmer that happened this past Tuesday. And what do we have, Terry?
Well, gee, I missed that sideshow, but I've heard lots about it for the last few days. Not uncommon in politics these days, and sort of sad when it seeps into real close-up community politics or community governing. But they had a pretty anguishing meeting on Tuesday. They did pass a budget. It sounds like, and I haven't listened to the tape of it yet, but it sounds like a great portion of the meeting was dedicated to getting rid of the mayor's assistant. And this is really a hot topic. There's been a lot of angst with the mayor's capacity in this town and from a couple of administrations. So I think we're on for quite a ride here. And we shouldn't let it be escaped that there's an election in October. And there will probably, there's at least one council seat in question and the mayor's seat. So how is that playing into this?
Zaz, did you have a chance to look into it at all?
Well, I started listening to the copy of the meeting. I wasn't actually at the meeting, and so I was listening to a recording and expected I'd get right into that budget discussion, maybe even hear a budget passed. And instead, I listened to the special meeting ahead and then also listened to the budget, quote-unquote, conversation, which did revolve for at least an hour, if not more, over Mayor Johnson's assistant, who is, I believe she's piggybacking on the city manager's assistant and paying out a certain number of hours depending on her needs. And so what Mayor Johnson has argued is that she's lobbying on behalf of the city, and this assistant, the help from assistant allows the city to have someone answering the phone when, you know, governments call, legislators call. And so, but what it boiled down to, you know, just listening was, I mean, you could hear the partisanship. And, you know, I have to say the council members, it was Council Member Best who proposed eliminating the position. I believe that was his stance last year as well. And Councilwoman Irby, Combs, both tried to make it clear that this was not a personality issue. But you really have to wonder when the council is this divided and you have about half the council saying, you know, we think communication between the mayor and the council is fine, and then you have at least three members saying communication has disintegrated. I think that word was actually used on Tuesday night. It really, it's painful, you know, as someone who cares about Palmer to listen to these conversations. I think it's like the fiscal cliff on the national level. It's like, can we just get to the business of running the city and not, you know, sniping at each other for an hour and a half on what's supposed to be a budget discussion?
Is anyone on the council rumored to be running for mayor?
There are some rumors, since we have only rumors and nothing else, we won't go to that. But I would say there are definitely rumors out there that at least one and possibly and quite probably maybe even two people are considering running. This is way out from the time when you have to commit and actually do it, but I think there are people testing the waters. Maybe just a little bit of background history on this whole thing. I'm fond of saying that if you were to line up all of the mayors in the borough, and that's starting with, let's start with the borough mayor. If you put the borough mayor, the Palmer mayor, the Wasilla mayor, and the Houston mayor all in a line, you would have every one of them being different in terms of what it means to be a mayor. And I think that's the important thing to keep in mind. And so when you look at the borough meetings, and many of us have spent time watching that, you realize that the borough mayor runs the meeting, but he votes in case of ties, mm-hmm. and he vetoes things. But he is not a member of the assembly. Now move over to Palmer, which is next in line. What do you have? You have a mayor who is a member of the city council. Okay? Member of the city council. Does not vote to break ties. Votes every time. And has no veto power. Now, there's a similarity in the sense that both the borough mayor and the city of Palmer mayor are part-time people. If you wander over to Wasilla, on the other hand, you have a totally different game. The city of Wasilla's mayor runs the meetings. But he's a full-time mayor. Full-time mayor. Paid, staff, etc. And so when you begin looking at all of these things and you realize that the city of Palmer has had a part-time mayor for some time, and if you've attended meetings over time, you realize that there have been a variety of approaches to find a way to increase the amount of time that the mayor would spend, and one way to do that is to both make a change in the policies and guidelines, and also, perhaps most importantly, to pay that mayor of a full-time salary. It's come and gone, up and down, all around, but at the present time, by charter, and it's a home rule city that we live in, and by the way things are set up, the mayor is a part-time mayor who is a member of the city council and has the duty to run the meeting. So that struggle, each time someone approaches being mayor, is worked out again. And I think it's being worked out this time. Obviously, the present mayor has expressed quite clearly her interest in being more than a part-time mayor. Now, what you've also mentioned here and along the way, I might add, I interviewed some people who were at the meeting, and I, like you, were not able to be there. But I do know that one of the issues that is rolled into this has to do with lobbying. From time to time, the city and as other entities have hired a professional lobbyist to do work. And at other times, individuals, sometimes the mayor, sometimes the manager, have been tasked with that duty. And there's kind of controversy over whether you need a full-time lobbyist or not. So what I come away from here is at this point, although the budget has been settled, there apparently isn't a lot of money in there for lobbying, and there is still a question of who is going to do the lobbyist. Will it be one of the more experienced council members who has previously served in Juneau? Will it be the mayor? Who will it be? And that will be discussed, I think, in January. That's another piece of it. Go ahead, Mark. Question?
Well, I'd say this gets to kind of a bigger question, and that is, you know, we keep hearing this same mantra that nobody wants to cut the budget, cut this, don't pay for anything, no new taxes. Everything needs to be very conservative. So I think, you know, question is, are we getting what we're paying for really? And really, is that what the people want? I mean, by the same voice that's passing $215 million school bonds and $32 million road bonds, and Palmer has virtually passed every school bond ever come to the community, Now, is that really the voice, is that we don't want to pay $20,000 a year for a position to make us appear like, you know, a city like everybody else? And I think it's ironic that during the assembly meeting, Mayor DeVilbiss said something that's kind of powerful to this, and it kind of shines to that lobbyist, is that it's Matsu's day, that they have their people in place. And he's, you know, and there are people on the assembly that are just itching to get down there and talk to who's representing them. It, by all appearances, the mayor has a pretty good relationship with the people in Juneau. So are they shooting themselves in the foot by this little kabuki dance of who's going to be in charge when and will the other cities walk away with the prize because they can't decide amongst themselves who's going to be queen for the day? And I think that's that should be troubling to the city of Palmer more than anything.
That's us.
Well, and I think that the special meeting that occurred before the budget also shined a light on, I don't know if it's because this council and mayor aren't getting along, but the city's list of priorities for state funding, I think it's 17 items long. And they even talked about, you know, are we at a disadvantage here? Are they going to laugh us out of their offices with, you know, how do you decide? So they spent some time shuffling items around to prioritize them. And they also, the mayor had to recuse herself on the matinee. They had to break out a matinee item because of the mayor's financial conflict on that one. So I think that the conflict on the council is rippling out, and just in terms of how well they can manage and how well Palmer can represent itself in Juneau beyond lobbying.
Well, one of the things, Terry, that was discussed at length and has resulted in a change is the health insurance for those right. people working for the city of Palmer. And that's a big deal. So they've apparently moved from a 90-10 split to an 80-20 split with higher copays. And so when you talk about $20,000 here or there, mm-hmm. given this council's penchant for looking at all dollars, there's some trade-off here. One might suspect that there, if the personnel were taking a cut of some sort, perhaps in addition, this was looked upon as a reasonable cut in that mayor's position, assistant position. The other thing that was curious, because you've all managed to find your way here to the studio, and it was curious to me that there was apparently no mention of tying directly the budget or discussion to snow removal. Because each year, that is always an issue, whether it's personnel or equipment, et cetera, how to make the situation work a little bit better. Because it's obvious that right now, many merchants still are raising questions about how to better do this. The city workers are out there as best they can doing things, but after snowfall, Palmer ceases to be a walking community. Mm-hmm. Maybe you got that. Okay, maybe we've covered enough of the City of Palmer's budget and other prospects. We had another event here that involved the shooting. Any detail you want to kick off on that one?
Well, it's obviously a tragedy, a senseless and hard-to-make-sense-of tragedy. I think for local people, and I have a wife who teaches in an elementary school and a son who attends one, so it's especially important and hard-hitting in that sense. But there was an incident in the local school district a year or so ago that called into question whether the district had a plan for something like this, which was also reported in the Frontiersman at the time. And that, it's encouraging to know that we have folks here in the district who think in those terms, even when it's very hard to think in those terms. There is a plan in place that's of some comfort. There's obviously no accounting for why this happens, when it might happen, or how to avoid it. Mm-hmm. But it's good to know that there's a plan at least.
Right. Zaz, Terry?
I have a first grader, and last year when she was in kindergarten, there was a situation at her school involving, I believe it was a distraught parent, a custody battle, and they went into lockdown immediately. I think the real horror of what happened today in Connecticut is that, as I understand it, this was a son who killed his mother, and all the children in her classroom. And, you know, if you're a family member, I don't see why a school would tell you you can't go do a classroom visit. I mean, these are just things we can't control.
Right.
I spoke with my daycare provider, who is a member of the LDS Church, and she said that some of her friends are having, at least one of her friends, is having kind of a crisis of faith today.
Okay. Okay. Maybe just a quick summary for those listeners who might have not missed what we're talking about, shooting in Connecticut, and brief details.
27 dead at last count. I heard that they expect more fatalities from among the injured. 18 of the dead are children. Yeah.
That's, yes, it gives one pause, no doubt about it. And as more information comes out, as we've found in the past when we've had somewhat similar, although this one is probably as horrific as mm-hmm. it could be, you get some understanding of how it happened and all the rest. But you're right. I think in looking locally, this is the kind of thing that reminds us to say, okay, what is in place in our own system, not only in schools but in the entire community that we live in, that can identify, if at all possible, ways in which this kind of thing doesn't catch fire and happen.
Well, I think I heard one comment that I thought was pretty accurate, and that's there's really no way to prepare for. I mean, you can do the best you can do, but this was a pretty sort of high-end suburb out in New York. There were people that lived out there because they didn't want to be in the city. They wanted to get away from the crime. Mayor Bloomberg in New York has been a very big advocate of gun control. This is certainly going to fuel some flames under that. But it certainly should put everything in context as far as, you know, what our priorities are and how grateful we are that, you know, that it wasn't one of our kids, because we're a small community, really, all a bunch of little small communities in Alaska, 700,000 in the whole state, and it could really happen anywhere. And it's happening way too frequently. And I think that's the question we have to ask ourselves, is why is it happening this frequently? And there's probably a lot of different avenues for to try to prepare us more, but it's a very troubling time.
Right. Yes, much more to say about that. Well, to finish up, we're here in a week very different from previous weeks. I'm looking outside through the window, and it's a different form of dark that's descending upon us, and it's more of a gray-white dark, and that's because the snow has come, and it's settling in pretty deeply. We had a report earlier this morning about the conditions for skiing this weekend. A lot of people going to be out and about doing all kinds of stuff. The roads are in reasonably good shape, although there's still snow here and there. And the whole feeling of the place, this valley, and particularly the city of Palmer, seems to be evolving as the snow gets deeper. Almost a sense of winter is finally here. It arrived in the second week of December this year. Any thoughts or comments about this snow affecting you?
Great news for recreationalists, obviously. Great news also for small, you know, the independent business types, snowplow drivers, and kudos, as always, to the public works crews, doing a great job under some pretty, you know, fast building and nasty conditions. Good to know that those folks are on the job.
Yeah, and that's an interesting thing, because what we have is a mix of different public works departments. If you wander down a road and you think, okay, this is the city, it might be the city, it might be the state, it might be the borough, because these roads all belong to different entities. And then you have people who take care of their driveways and all the rest. And as we have been often reminded, don't put the snow across the road when you plow out the driveway. Zaz, any comments?
My comment would be, if you are going to recreate this weekend, whether you're going to ski or snow machine, the word is avalanche, and just be very careful. I was watching a not great presentation on Channel 2 about avalanche safety, and but one of the most important takeaways, I think, was before you go out, you know, check. There's, you can get an avalanche forecast here, and you can get one online. This big load of snow on top of a really cold kind of greeny layer, it tends to slip, and it can be really dangerous. And sometimes the most dangerous day is the first day you can actually get out in it, a nice sunny day. So it's starting to settle. So I don't know if this weekend we'll find things a little bit improved. But if you're not an expert, make sure you get an expert and to give you some good advice about where it's safe to go out and play.
Okay, Terry?
Well, those are all both good points. I particularly like Mark's, just because I think we forget how the dollar trickle downs in the valley and how many the snow does put a lot of people to work, and they end up spending their money at the merchants that are trying to have the best part of their year right now and may have caught off to a slow start because the snow plowers and everybody wasn't having a little overtime and that kind of thing that makes people compulsively buy things they probably don't need but that they want. And they don't go to Anchorage when the snow's like this to shop. They stay in the valley because they hear all the noise about driving into Anchorage. So it has a lot of positive effects that, you know, stay here in the valley and the pocket's here.
Yeah, great reminder about the value of shopping local this time of year. Retailers especially, you know, this is their bread and butter. You think about all the people in the valley, and I know in the past I have been quick to be an online shopper. You know, if you think about everybody who's shopping for friends and relatives, if each of those people here spent $100 at a local store or stores that they would otherwise have spent online, it's a huge, huge economic impact. So a good reminder to folks to do a good thing and shop local this Christmas.
Okay. Yeah, with that, there we go. Well, we've come to the end of another session of the Valley Edition. It's that quick. It just runs through. You start, you talk, and it's all over. So Zaz Hollander, Mark Kelsey. It's the Polish influence. I can see it in your face. And Terry Snyder, thank you very much for coming in, and we'll be back again next week.